Welcome to Historians on the Record, brought to you by the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. I'm Jim Basker, president of the Institute. Our mission is to promote the study and love of American history through programs such as these. Please visit us on the web at www.gilderlehrman.org to sign up for our mailing list and learn more about our resources for teachers and students.
All right. I want to actually spend this next session, the rest of this session, talking about the complicated story of implementing Brown. After it decided Brown, the court, as you know, ordered yet another re-argument, this one on the question of remedy. So now that we know that segregation is unconstitutional, what are we going to do about it? And it was at the remedy stage that the underlying ambiguity in the Brown opinion revealed itself, because the court wasn't entirely clear in Brown in saying just what the constitutional problem was. And so how to remedy it was also unclear. Was the constitutional flaw having laws that explicitly required segregation? If that was the flaw, then it'd be enough to just get those laws off the books. Or was the constitutional problem something produced by educating children in race-segregated schools? Right? In other words, was the consequence an inherent part of the constitutional violation, in which case more would be required and states would have to take affirmative steps toward integration? So which of those does Brown require? It depends on which of the two rationales suggested in the opinion you emphasize. If the constitutional harm is the stigma attached to state-imposed segregation, then state neutrality with respect to laws solves the constitutional problem. The state is no longer creating the stigma. You'd need only to desegregate, to eliminate formal state action as a cause for segregated schools. If, on the other hand, the harm is an educational disadvantage that black children experience, or that black and white children experience by virtue of segregation, from being educated in one race schools, then the remedy requires affirmative integration. So the court ducked that ambiguity in Brown too, and instead just remanded the case back to school, to district courts, to trial courts, with instructions to admit public, I love this, admit public schools on a racially non-discriminatory basis, order schools to admit students on a racially non-discriminatory basis, whatever that means, right? That's the question. What do you mean by a racially non-discriminatory basis? And to do so with, of course, all deliberate speed. The all deliberate speed part was the more controversial part at the time, because the court was essentially giving its okay to some unknown amount of delay to implement whatever remedy was going to be required. They did that because they cited logistical and administrative problems. But you know, in truth, inside the court, that was only part of the, those are true. There were. It was a big problem. But that was only part of the story. They were, in fact, worried about Southern resistance, and they wanted to leave some space to encourage or try and slowly coerce compliance. So Warren says in the opinion that principle can't yield because of disagreement, but of course that's exactly what the court was doing, yielding. So the South read Brown 2 as a victory. Right? It seemed to signal that resistance is not futile, and that it could actually work. More important, it turned the issue back over to local school boards. Right? Local school boards were directed to come up with plans and submit them to local federal judges, who, although they were federal, were still mostly were local. Right? So the federal district judges, there were a few exceptions here that have tended to get played up in the later literature, Minor Wisdom, Sam Johnson, and so on. But the vast majority of the district judges in the southern states were themselves southerners and supporters of Jim Crow, and so were not too uncomfortable working with the school board to figure out ways to change nothing. Okay, now I do think you have to, it's hard to Monday morning quarterback the court's decision. You know, the overwhelming consensus these days is that Brown too encouraged resistance and sacrificed the rights of at least a generation of students. I don't know, you know, from the perspective of the justices trying to maximize the desegregation effort and worried that if we get overly aggressive, we're going to get even more resistance and maybe no desegregation at all. That's the way it would have plausibly looked. So I don't know what I would have done were I them. Bear in mind that it wasn't initially clear whether Eisenhower would support the court or not. Right? So the federal government submitted a brief in Brown 2, and the brief that was submitted by the Eisenhower administration supported gradualism. And it wasn't until 1957 in Little Rock that Eisenhower made clear that he would call out the troops if necessary. So that wasn't completely clear in 54, 55. And they wanted the federal government wanted gradualism. You're worried about whether they'll support a more aggressive effort. You're worried about how much resistance there'll be and whether you'll accomplish anything. So it's not implausible to sort of kind of think we'll try this out a little slower. And, of course, Congress was out of the picture here. Nobody expected any help from Congress because, you know, Southern Democrats, together with Republicans, were able to bottle up anything that was going to come out of Congress or filibuster any proposed legislation. So Congress was no help at all. You were going to need the executive. So, plausible. Was there a question? It's the same case. It's the same case. So they had deferred, right? But that's just the court. What the court said is they decided the case. They deferred deciding what remedy. Having reached the conclusion, they deferred a remedy and then said, "We want you to re-argue this for us. We want you all to go and think about how to remedy this and give us more information so we can figure it out." So it's not a new case.
Does that happen often in Supreme Court?
Not often, but it happens. It's not particularly unusual. I mean, it happens rarely. In big cases, when it does, typically, but and everybody knew this was a big case, but it wasn't some like strange and exotic procedure. Anyway, of course, what the court did get from Brown too was massive resistance and token compliance. Politically, Brown turns out to be a flashpoint for the opposition. So race and desegregation instantly become a salient political issue in the South, which it hadn't really been, producing a big shift to the right. Southern politicians who had previously been kind of moderate and even progressive, like George Wallace or Orville Faubus, both of whom prior to this were actually moderate Democrats and on the progressive side, moved strongly to the right to maintain support and became ardent desegregationists. Southern politics became a contest to see who could be sort of, you know, the most strongly opposed, the most racist. And more moderate voices, of which there were quite a few in the South, were quickly drowned out, a problem made worse by malapportionment. Okay, the resistance took a lot of different forms. Some of it was rhetorical, like the Southern Manifesto, which almost all, I think, of the Southern members of Congress signed, calling on states to ignore Brown. And then there were also a bunch of the Southern legislatures adopted interposition resolutions. This is hearkening back to nullification, interposition resolutions, declaring their intent to resist what they claimed was an unconstitutional decision. Now, again, there was nothing, it has become common that said all this is illegitimate. The Supreme Court had decided. They have no authority to say that it's unconstitutional. As I say, not only do I not think that's right, but that was not the established understanding at the time. And even the supporters of Brown were uncomfortable with the notion of the... So to say that they were wrong, say, to oppose Brown, is not the same thing as saying it was illegitimate, right? To say the Supreme Court has spoken, but we don't accept its authority on this. More harmful than sort of, you know, that kind of rhetorical stuff was the actual economic and violent retaliation inflicted on civil rights advocates and even moderate whites. The plaintiffs in the desegregation suits were fired from their jobs or evicted from their homes. NAACP offices were suddenly being investigated for communist connections. They had their membership lists published in newspapers. There was a big resurgence in the KKK, murders, lynchings. Alongside that, you had the new White Citizens Councils, which were the genteel version of the KKK. So they were organized. Instead of using violence, they would use economic pressure to bear on people, get people fired from their jobs, and so on. But there was a lot of violence, not just small scale, some major rioting. And there was a fair amount of it. The most famous, of course, is the incident that arose in Little Rock in 1957. So this is where, right, Governor Orville Faubus calls out his the State National Guard to block the admission of 9 students. Faubus is a great example. He was an economic populist. He was a racial moderate. He had been elected by a biracial coalition. And prior to this, Little Rock had been among the most racially progressive cities in the South. Arkansas had been the first state voluntarily to desegregate its university. Blacks voted in large numbers in Arkansas. There were a lot of black employees in the state and local governments. But you get this big switch. The governor realizes that to stay in power, to become a significant political figure, he needs to shift over. He does. Eisenhower sends in federal troops from the 101st Airborne, forces the National Guard to yield and admit the students. That incident produces the only other statement from the Supreme Court in the 1950s on this issue. After the army arrives, so Faubus calls up the National Guard, says we're not going to admit them. Eisenhower calls out the troops. They force the admission of the students. After the army arrives, the local federal district judge tried to end the desegregation effort. Right? His decision to as a issue an order, in other words, saying the school does not have to desegregate because of all this violence, goes up to the Supreme Court, which orders him to proceed. In an opinion, now what's extraordinary about the opinion, this is Cooper v. Aarons is the case. It's a single, normally if you look at these opinions, it'll be Justice Marshall delivered the opinion for the court, or Chief Justice Warren delivered an opinion for the court. That means Chief Justice Marshall or Chief Justice Warren wrote it, and they're delivering it, and the other justices agree, and they sign the opinion. What happened in Cooper v. Aarons is actually all 9 of them signed the opinion. First and only time that that's happened. So it's an opinion of all 9 judges. So it's not, Justice Brennan actually wrote it, but it's not Justice Brennan delivered an opinion of the court. It's Chief Justice Warren and Justices, and I'm not going to remember all 9 names now, they're all just listed there, delivered an opinion. And basically, they did that self-consciously to display their commitment to what they had started to do in Brown. Of course, the court only got that bold, and it's in this opinion where they declare that they are supreme over the law of the Constitution, and that since they've spoken, everybody's now obliged to follow. They only did that, of course, after it was clear that Eisenhower would call out the troops. But at that point, they felt comfortable declaring their supremacy. As I say, at the time Cooper came out, that part of the opinion was greeted with widespread skepticism, even among supporters of the court. By 1960, resistance in the Upper South has faded. Okay, business interests are just tired because resisting takes a lot of time and energy, and it's costing them money. So instead, what they did in the Upper South was they chose to permit token integration. But in the Deep South, the defiance remains. And all through the South, states begin to adopt more sophisticated methods of defeating segregation than the outright defiance of, you know, Little Rock. Some jurisdictions close their public schools altogether, then offer tuition grants for every student to attend a private school. Of course, the private schools are all white, right? But there's no state action, so they can't regulate the private schools. So in theory, there are similar grants available to black students. They just don't have any schools to attend. Now, the black middle class could have formed their own schools, and there's actually debate about this, but members of the black middle class didn't want to yield to this transparent effort to defeat segregation, and other blacks were too poor to be able to effectively organize and create schools. In other jurisdictions, they created these really complex pupil placement schemes, basically to allow local school boards to integrate on a student-by-student basis, which of course meant allowing them to maintain one-race schools. By 1964, it looked like the resistance was succeeding. So here you are 10 years after Brown, 1964, and only about 1-2% of blacks in the South attend schools that are not entirely one race. And the Supreme Court has said nothing. There's not been a word out of them. It's not that the cases weren't brought. It's just that they've ducked them all or found ways not to hear them.
Is that 2% nationally or just in the South?
That's in the South. Nationally, there's no change in the North because, again, in this phase, Brown only speaks to formal de jure laws requiring segregation. So, by 1964, of course, the political climate in the country has changed pretty significantly. The civil rights movement is increasingly effective in mobilizing opinion in the North. This is Martin Luther King's strategy of nonviolent provocation was designed to provoke Southern officials and white mobs to use violence deliberately, which would then shock people in the North and convince Northerners of the barbarity of Jim Crow and the need to actually change it. In effect, TV makes the civil rights movement, right? In 1950, only 10% of people in the country have TVs. By 1960, it's 90% of the people in the country who have TVs. The most important single protest here is the Birmingham marches in April of 63. And King chose Birmingham quite self-consciously because it was the most segregated city in the South, but also because he expected its police chief, the aptly named Bull Connor, he expected Connor to overreact, which, of course, Connor did. So suddenly on TV, you had these scenes of small children attacked by dogs, right, sprayed with hoses that could tear the bark off a tree at 100 feet, stuff like that. And that produced a powerful counter-reaction in the North. President Kennedy was quoted as saying that he was sickened by this. A civil rights bill was immediately introduced into Congress. Wasn't passed until the following year, aided by, unfortunately, by Kennedy's assassination. But the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, which grew directly out of this, are the most important pieces of civil rights legislation still. So the Civil Rights Act does, what it's mostly known for was prohibiting race discrimination in employment and in public accommodations. And we talked yesterday about Heart of Atlanta and Katzenbach v. McClung. But more important for this purpose, it gave the Attorney General authority to institute school desegregation lawsuits so that the federal government could be the litigant. And more important still, really the most important thing, what it did was it authorized the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to cut off federal funds to school districts that failed to comply with HEW guidelines on integration. And that really was the effective device. It's the withholding of federal money, because it was more easily done, and it was immediately effective. So integration took off. By 1966, the 2% of black students in integrated schools had become 12%, and by 69, that figure was above 30%. This is, again, still in the South. And this is, for those of you who have read Mike Klarman's book, this is really the heart of his story, right, which is that Brown's effect on racial change was perverse and accidental. The decision itself didn't bring anything about, either as a practical matter or in changing people's attitudes. What it did do was it catalyzed Southern racists whose activities then provoked deliberately by leaders of the civil rights movement. Finally, produced so much bad acts, so many bad acts that people saw that produced a backlash. So you have a backlash to Brown, which produces a backlash against the backlash, and finally motivates Congress and the president to get involved, and that's what finally produces some change. Not surprising then, around this time, finally feeling a little more secure, the Supreme Court decides it can get back in the action. So there's one case in 1964, Griffin, the county school board. Although I think Griffin is not really yet the sign of any major reintrusion. It's just worth mentioning. It's a case that involves one of the original Brown plaintiffs, Prince Edward County in Virginia. And Prince Edward County is one of the counties that responded by just closing its schools down altogether. It worked just fine. They used property tax credits to fund students who wanted to go to private schools, which, of course, the white students did. Most blacks had no schools to go to, and so on. And in Griffin, the court concluded that closing your schools down altogether violated the Equal Protection Clause. And they ordered the public schools reopened. Now, on the surface, this was not an easy case, right? The state is not under an obligation to offer public education. There is no constitutional right to public education. The Equal Protection Clause, as the court had now interpreted it, simply requires the state not to segregate if it chooses to offer public education. So how do you then get to the state says, fine, we just won't offer any public education at all. What the court said is, well, we're going to look at your motive or your purpose in choosing not to order public education. So it might be that you could choose not to offer any public education for non-race-based reasons. If it was just too damn expensive and you thought you could do this more cheaply or effectively, we would have nothing to say about this. But you can't close the public schools solely because of opposition to integration. Okay? So in other words, even though the outcome is formal equality, if the motive was racially based, motive purpose is enough without regard to effect. I mention that because the court did not stick to that holding. And a couple of years later, in a case called Palmer v. Thompson, they actually backed off on it. Palmer v. Thompson involved a case in which, Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi, they closed the public pools altogether so that blacks and whites wouldn't have to swim in the same pools. And the court said that that was okay, even though the intent was racially based, because the effect was now nobody had pools, right? Blacks and whites equally lacked public pools. And it was the same effects in that lots of white people had pools in their backyards. There was lots of private white pools. But the court says, you know, we're not looking at, what we're looking at is access to public pools, access to public schools. So these two cases just stand in opposition to one another. And again, I think all I want to point out is that just recognize that the court in this period was confused about whether equal protection was concerned with purposes or effects. And we'll come back to that. The first really important case after Brown is Green, which is also versus Green versus School Board, which is actually 1968. So now it's 14 years after Brown, 4 years after the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act has really begun to take effect. The national consensus within the country is looking very different, although we've obviously still got a long way to go. And it was here that the court finally indicated that it had lost patience with foot dragging, and the court says, we want segregation now.
Desegregation,
yes, sorry. And the in Green, what the actual issue was, they unanimously rejected the freedom of choice plans. So this was one of the devices by which segregation was persisted. What the school district would do is they would end formal assignments and instead say students can choose which school they want to attend. So in theory, that should...
Schools, right?
In this case, yes, they just had two schools.
One white, one black.
So. Right, but there's no assignment. So now students can sign up to go to whichever school they want. And, of course, what would happen is none of the white children would choose to attend the poorly funded public black school. If black parents did try and send their kids to the white schools, they found themselves fired from their jobs or threatened with violence, so they would back off from that. Or in the case that they didn't, then they were told, well, sorry, the school's already full, it's too late. So the freedom of choice plans, while on their face looking like full compliance with Brown, in practice were no compliance at all. And as I say, the court says no more, right? No, you have to end segregation now. But it was at this point that the implicit uncertainty with respect to the scope of Brown becomes manifest, right? Because once you have a school choice plan, the state is no longer formally mandating segregation. And on a narrow reading of Brown, that's all that's required. There is no longer any formal de jure segregation in the state. The court in Green gives a different response, right? It's not enough simply to dismantle the state apparatus that created segregated schools. Rather, Brown requires that you have to dismantle the dual system and create a system that is unitary. That is, it's not enough to end desegregation, but you have to affirmatively integrate. Okay, and yeah, somebody pointed out Green was an easy case. In this sense, segregation had existed by law, and a way to integrate the schools was super easy because the county was like, I think it's like 50% black and 57% black and 43% white, and they were dispersed in their housing. So you could just draw a line right down the middle of the county, and you would get two integrated schools. And this is a general point, right? In general, integration in the South turns out to be not too difficult once you try to do it. That is to say, it gets difficult in the cities, right? Because housing patterns are much more sharply defined in the cities than they are outside the cities. And so neighborhood schools won't automatically achieve integration, and that complicates the remedial issues. But in the country districts where most of these things started, there was not, once you said you have to do it, it turned out to be not too difficult to do. So the first desegregation case involving a city school, so now, and again, the way you want to see this is, it's interesting, it really unfolds almost, you know, in a logical, natural way. So as this begins to happen, as I say, there's total resistance everywhere. The first cases the courts take where they begin to push back involve cases where the solution is easy. Once you've made clear that you're going to do it, the solution is easy. So here, what did they say? It's not enough to dismantle the formal segregated system. You've got to produce integration, but it's easy to do. It's hard, as I said, in the cities. And so the next case that they take is a city case. Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg. Did I spell that right? Yeah, okay. And by the way, so now we're up to 1971. Yeah, Swan v. It's Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education. So the city of Charlotte used freedom of choice plans with neighborhood schools, which naturally produced little or no integration. The district court solved it by ordering in-out busing between the inner-city black schools and the outlying white schools in the neighborhoods right outside the center of the city. Okay, here's where things begin to really fall apart. The opinion is a disaster, just an analytical disaster, mainly because it was written by Chief Justice Berger. Well, I mean that in two senses. So one is Berger disagreed with the result. The court has been unanimous in all of these cases. They've worked very hard to maintain their unanimity. And although he disagrees with the result, once it's clear he's going to lose, Berger switches the vote in order to control the opinion, because as chief, he gets to assign it to himself. So he wasn't really in favor of the outcome that they were reaching, and is going to then write it in the way that will minimally change the law to deal with it, added to the fact that, in truth, and I will say this here, he was also extremely dumb.
Great hair.
Yeah, he looked like, you know, it's famous. I mean, he looked like a chief justice, and he was, I once wrote, the year I clerked, I did a draft of an opinion for a joke in which I put a line, I knew it was a draft, so I was going to get it. I put a line in that said, this is true as obvious as the fact that dropping a rock on Chief Justice Berger's head will produce a loud, hollow noise. Justice Brennan freaked when he saw it. He said, get rid of that. What if that got out? That'll get edited out of any lectures. In any event, what Berger does in this opinion, though, is while the court unanimously does uphold the plaintiff's claim and does affirm the in-out busing solution, it does so in a manner that plants the seeds that would undo the jurisprudence. Okay, so first, Berger says that all that's unconstitutional is legally mandated segregation, that integration is not itself constitutionally required. On the other hand, integration may nevertheless be ordered where segregation has been legally mandated in the past. Okay? In other words, what the court does is it resolves the ambiguity that was implicit in Brown differently than one might have thought Green was doing. Green seemed to suggest, no, the constitutional violation entails is the lack of integration. And what the court says in Swan is, no, the constitutional violation is legal segregation. But if a school has had a legally segregated system in the past, you can order integration as a remedy to it. So it's not the right. You have no right to integration. But integration may, in appropriate circumstances, be an appropriate remedial measure that the court can use to address the consequences of the violation of the right, which was state-ordered segregation. Okay, so again, segregation can have occurred in one of two different ways. Segregation might just be de facto, right? It might be not a result of affirmative efforts by state actors to produce segregation, but simply something produced by private factors like housing patterns. Or it might be de jure. It might be a product of efforts by the states to create segregated schools. In the latter instance, which was, of course, true everywhere in the South, the state had an affirmative obligation to dismantle the dual system it had created and replace it with a unitary integrated system. So the effect of SWAN is to attach an affirmative duty to integrate on every school in the South, but only schools in the South. More important, it meant that the remedy the court had just ordered went beyond the right that it had recognized, which was going to, of course, eventually create pressures from opponents of all this that they could use to exploit, that they could exploit, rather, to force the court to back down. It's hard to do, you know, right? The idea is the remedy should be tailored to the right. There's no reason for the remedy to order more than the right actually entails by way of violation. And if the violation was just the de jure segregation, then eliminating it should be a full remedy. But the court in Swan unanimously, see, and so you've got to think how the dynamics are working in the courts. They've got nine justices. They don't want more than one opinion. So they're going to go along with this. Berger controls who gets to write the opinion and assigned it to himself. So he wrote the opinion, and so they're kind of reluctantly going, because it still gets them to the result they want, which is that all the schools that had the formal segregation in the past now have an affirmative obligation to integrate. And no one's quite seeing what's going to happen in the following cases. But they've planted this seed because the remedy goes beyond the right that later on opponents will use to push back on what the courts are doing. Second, Swan was not a difficult case when it came to it, right? Why? Because Charlotte and most of the southern cities actually used countywide school districts. Okay, so let's say their school districts weren't defined by city limits, so the busing that the court ordered was still within the same district. So they were busing kids from one part of the district to another part of the district. But, you know, it was, to the extent that you had these houses. So I guess what I want to say is this. What Swan does is raise for the first time in a way that Green did not the problem of housing patterns and the incredible difficulty that segregated housing patterns causes when you want to integrate your schools. But it did it in what was still a relatively uncontroversial context because the school district encompassed all of the blacks and the whites. So what the court does, and the way the court responds, this is one of the arguments in the case, right? And the way the court responds to the housing pattern issue also creates problems later on. In a nutshell, what the court says is the housing pattern, that's just a de facto circumstance for purposes of school desegregation. That is, it may be that the housing patterns are also a product of segregation, of state-sponsored efforts to produce segregated housing patterns, but it's got nothing to do with schools. They didn't, whatever actions they took to create segregation in housing was not to create segregation in schools. And the only things that matter if we're worrying about state action when it comes to segregation in schools is things the state did to create segregated schools. So maybe not, they did something to create segregated housing, and maybe an effect of segregated housing is to create segregated schools. But if that's it, you can't take the fact that the state may have engineered the housing in some way as something that you can use to bolster your authority in dealing with the school problem. Okay? Put another way, segregated housing is not going to be treated as something produced by state actions for purposes of Brown, unless it had been created by state actors in order to keep the schools segregated. And of course, that proves to be a huge liability because most segregation, especially in the North, is a product of housing. And although it had often been deliberately created by the state, it had not ever been deliberately created by the state in order to produce segregated schools. So that meant that efforts to undo segregation were again going to require the court to order remedies that would exceed the scope of the right as they had just defined it. So that when you, if and when you try and deal with the housing issues, you're going beyond the right because whatever state action produced the segregated housing isn't treated as part of the right at issue in the school case. Now, as I say, I think it's worth noting that you didn't have to treat housing that way. Segregated housing is unquestionably at least partly a product of state action. In a whole slew of ways, federal and state housing policy had long explicitly fostered segregated housing. There had been subsidized mortgages only in racially segregated neighborhoods. State financing of development often took place only in separate areas. Highways and airports and roads were placed quite deliberately in order to create or preserve segregated housing and so on. Am I the only one from Chicago? I mean, Chicago, if you look, when Daley was mayor in the 50s, they quite self-consciously and deliberately laid out all of the highways, the airports, to preserve the segregated neighborhoods. And Chicago remains probably the most segregated city. I should say it wasn't just black-white. In Chicago, they wanted to isolate the Polish from the Irish, and I always tell my daughter, the world that I grew up in, there was tons of racism. It didn't have quite the same edge that it has today because it was like that old Jim Lehrer song where everybody kind of hated everybody else. And, the area I grew up in, there was a Jewish neighborhood, an Irish neighborhood, an Italian neighborhood, a Polish neighborhood, and so on. And everybody, in a world where sort of that kind of prejudice is pervasive, it's not that it just has a different kind of edge when the world has boiled down to essentially, race, right? That's race and a little vestigial religious stuff. But in Chicago, as I say, you can see there was really self-conscious choices made by state and city decision makers about how to preserve the segregated housing in neighborhoods that existed. So you could easily say state action is state action. So, state action about housing, state action about schools, is still state action that has produced this effect, and we can think about it all as one aspect and say, so insofar as state action produced the housing that produces the segregated schools, of course it's part of the right that's been violated in much the same way that a formal state law requiring segregation is. But the court didn't want to go down that path.
So can you just, go back over just very quickly. If housing is a state law or a state action that's done in order to segregate schools, does that make...
If that was the reason, then it would be part of Brown. Then it would be part of...
Okay.
Right, but that was never the case.
No,
because before Brown, if you were, in the way, if you wanted to segregate schools, you segregated schools, right? You didn't think you had to do it in this sort of, nefarious way. People didn't need it. They wanted to segregate neighborhoods. They segregated neighborhoods. They took things for that.
It wasn't state action, then you couldn't.
Well, it wasn't state action involving schools.
Right.
Yeah. Now, again, all this stuff that I'm talking about, these are potential doctrinal problems that really did little to interfere with desegregation in the South once the efforts had begun in earnest, right? Green's use of neighborhood schools produced a lot more integration in rural areas, and Swan's use of busing worked for most southern cities. And that was mainly because southern school districts were largely countywide. That meant that suburban schools could be integrated while remaining majority white, making white flight less of a problem, right? You could ship blacks within the same district to some of the suburban schools easily, and you wouldn't have flight outside so much. You could control your numbers and so on. The problems emerged only when civil rights activists began to make efforts to desegregate in the North. Because while few northern cities had ever had formal de jure laws requiring school segregation, most of them had taken other kinds of actions to produce the same result. So we move to the North in the next case, and that's Keyes versus Denver School District 1. Okay. I thought we were going to make sure I got the name right. Keyes versus School District Number 1, Denver, whatever, close enough. 1973. Okay, so we treat Denver as a northern city. We treat it as a northern city, of course, because it had never mandated segregation by statute. But, you know, like most, as blacks began to move into the cities, adopted subtle strategies to sort of keep neighborhoods sacrosanct. In the case of Denver, what they had mainly done was site their schools strategically to maximize segregation. That is to say, they gerrymandered attendance zones and did things like that in order to take advantage of housing patterns in order to produce segregated schools. Now, that is de jure segregation, right? In other words, de jure just means that it's done by the state. So the most obvious forms of de jure segregation are a law that say the schools shall be segregated. But state action designed to produce segregation is still de jure, even if it doesn't say it on its face. So choosing to put the schools, we'll put one school in the heart of this black neighborhood, we'll put one school over in this white neighborhood, or we have these schools, let's draw the zones like this so that all the black people are in this neighborhood and all the white people are in this neighborhood. Those are the same kinds of actions. That counts as de jure segregation. It's just harder to prove. So in Denver, what happened was the plaintiffs could show that self-conscious state actions had been taken to produce segregation in one neighborhood, the Park Hill neighborhood. And then in the rest of the city, the work was done for the school board by the housing patterns. Okay? So what the court in Keyes held was that if you could show de jure segregation in a meaningful portion of a school district, that can justify district-wide relief, like busing. In other words, and you see what matters here. So here's the whole school district. And it's divided up into school districts. Right? And you say, okay, see this district? I can offer you evidence that shows that the way this district was drawn was in order to produce, these were blacks, these were whites. They wanted all the blacks in one school. They wanted all the whites in a different school. And that's why they did this. So that's a violation. Now, so far it's only a violation with respect to these two. So what the court says is that, since that's a meaningful portion of the district, justifies a presumption that the whole district was a product of de jure segregation. That we'll treat the district as a whole. And what follows is you can order whatever remedies then are necessary within the whole district, including busing. Okay? Now, because what we're really looking at is say, this is all black, and 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 these are all white. This is the only one that we know. We have proof that we're deliberately engineered this way, but once we have the presumption, then we don't have to leave kids in these four districts in one-race schools. We can begin to bus them into these districts. Not because that's not the right, that's the remedy.
You said the word, the test they use, a meaningful part of the district that
yeah.
they used. Did they do that, they think, statistically, or how did they
now, it's much looser.
Meaning,
I mean, again, there's not enough cases to know. This never got pushed all that far, but it just meant not insignificant, you know. Yeah. What Keyes does, the effect of Keyes is that holding is to put almost all northern cities in the same place as the South. Mm-hmm. Right? Because remember, once you've got a finding of de jure segregation, then what attaches automatically is a remedial duty to integrate. And while showing de jure segregation can be more difficult, it could be done in virtually every northern city. And again, the holding of Keyes is once you've shown it for part of the city, then you can order relief across the whole city. I don't know if you go back later over the materials, look at Justice Powell's opinion in Keyes. It's a concurrence. It's a really interesting opinion. Powell was from Virginia. More importantly, Powell had served on the Virginia school board during the early years after Brown. And it's plainly been bothering him that northern cities don't have the same obligations and problems to solve as the southern ones just because of this de jure de facto distinction. Right? So he thinks the same, look, you know, once you've got segregated schools, in fact, the same obligations to integrate should exist nationwide. So for that reason, he goes along with this decision here because, as I say, its effect is to put all the northern cities in the same boat as the southern cities. Now everybody in the country has this obligation. At the same time, though, Powell is deeply skeptical about busing, which he, like many others, views as expensive, as time-consuming, and as bad for education because it limits the possibilities for parents to be involved in schools. And he believes, like many Southern politicians, if you just put Northerners in the same position as we are, support for this is going to evaporate really rapidly. They're all in favor of busing when it's us. But if they have to do it in their own schools and in their own cities, you know, they're never going to tolerate what they're forcing the South to do. And, of course, Powell turns out to be exactly right. Right? Because while not formally doing away, Keyes doesn't formally do away with the de jure de facto distinction, its effect is that. Now, it doesn't matter that there were never these formal laws. You can always show proof that something was done by the state to maintain segregation in some part of a city, and boom, that's enough to make the whole city have to integrate its schools. And so now every city's in the same place, and suddenly federal courts are ordering northern cities to bus, and the reactions are immediate. There's riots in Boston as early as 1974. I remember them. And polls show that everybody hates busing, blacks as well as whites. Okay, and it's against this background that the court decides Milliken v. Bradley. It's 1974. This is Milliken 1. There's two Millikens. Same case again. It comes back twice. This is really the turning point for busing and school desegregation generally, because in all these cases, they're extending the right. Right? This is the court really pushing the agenda, forcing cities to do something, creating rules that apply to more and more cities and forcing them to integrate. This is Detroit. The problems in Detroit are actually typical of a northern city. Wealthier whites had moved into the suburbs. In most northern cities, though, unlike in the South, the suburbs are separate school districts. And, of course, because of white flight, you've got cities that are overwhelmingly one race. So Detroit is a city that's like, the city's 80% black, 20% white. The suburbs are, you know, 95% white, 5% black. And they're separate school districts. Finding de jure segregation in some parts of the Detroit system, because, you know, that they could do that. So the district court orders busing. But when the school is 80% black and 20% white, you can't really achieve much relief by ordering busing just within the city. So the court says, we're going to do busing outside the city to the suburbs. Some kids from the suburbs are going to come into the city. Some kids from the city are going to go out into the suburbs. In a 5-4 decision, so boom, this is where we lose. We no longer have unanimity as of this point. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court holds that Keyes is limited to the district in question. And it's one thing to say if you can show de jure segregation in part of a district, you can presume, if you can show de jure segregation in part of a district, you can presume de jure segregation for the whole district. It's another thing to say that because you can show de jure segregation in part of one district, you can presume segregation in another district, which was governed by a separate school board. You can't do that. And if you don't have any proof of de jure segregation in the other district, you can't impose your remedy on them. And, of course, there was no evidence of de jure segregation in the white suburban suburbs. There had never been a need. Right? So there's no integration in the suburbs. Only whites live there. And the court says, absent some evidence that district lines were gerrymandered in order to create segregated schools, there's no basis for busing the suburban kids. And they weren't. It was just the standard practice to have the suburbs as separate school districts. And that was common practice in the North. Now, the court doesn't really justify or explain why inter-district lines are more sacred than intra-district lines, right? Because the court overrode those in Keyes. Justice Marshall accused the court, you're just buckling under to the public pressure that's been, you know, growing here and so on. I think there's a plausible argument in as much as they're governed by, you know, unless our just assumption is everybody wanted segregated schools, so they were going to do it, even if they didn't do it because they didn't have to, they would have. We should just assume everybody wants it, which would probably go a little far. That, you know, there is a reason to think that different districts governed by different school boards, you can't necessarily just, you know, attribute the same violation across lines. In any event, what the effect of Milliken is to leave city schools around the country, although especially in the North and West, irremediably segregated. And of course, from a policy perspective and a political perspective, these three cases taken together are a disaster. Right? White flight continues apace. At the same time that Swan and Keyes authorize aggressive busing within the city. So Milliken secures affluent white suburbs free from this, while within the city everybody's being forced to move around to achieve whatever they can. And after Milliken, people across the political spectrum begin seriously rethinking the goals of desegregation. The NAACP and its spin-off, the Inc. Fund, don't change. Right? They litigate virtually every desegregation case, and they continue to see integration as a top priority. They continue to push very hard for busing. Some black leaders and some parts of the civil rights community take the position that racial integration for its own sake ought to be treated as less important than improving the education of black children. And, you know, again, it's an interesting shift. I mean, some of it seems to me it makes sense. That is to say, the court in Brown views separation as tantamount to inequality. But 1984 looks different than 1954. And it no longer seemed right simply to assume that putting blacks in the same room with whites would improve black education or white education. And some black leaders begin to reconsider and to urge giving up on busing and integration and shift the focus to just getting better schools. After all, who has to get up at 4 in the morning and take a 3-hour bus ride to get to school, right? And it was unclear just what the educational benefits were, right? Whether what mattered was being in a class with white kids or what mattered was being in a school that had better funding, better facilities, better teachers, and so on.
Is this when some of the plans for, like, magnet schools in cities and districts started to come about, like in the early 80s,
yes,
early 70s? Getting white residents of the same city who may have had like a de facto segregated school a reason to come to schools that are underfunded and mostly people of color?
Yes. This is all of that begins in this period. And interestingly enough, I mean, when you get to it, I wasn't going to talk, but there's the Missouri v. Jenkins case. The Supreme Court says you can't use devices. So one of the way to get around Milliken was in Missouri, you have exactly the same problem. And what the court does is it authorizes orders, I think. The school proposes a plan, which the court signs on to, in which what it will do is it will create magnet schools in order to attract kids from the suburbs. And the court says, no, you can't do that, because that's inter-district relief, which we said was beyond your authority in Milliken. Now, there's a wild difference between, right, creating a magnet school that might attract kids to come who might not otherwise, and you're not forcing them to and ordering them to be bused. But the court says no difference, and this is because, of course, as you roll into the 80s, the court itself has moved very far away from this.
What about within the same district?
You can do it, and it's done.
Yes,
all that stuff emerges in the early 1980s, as does, of course, you know, the whole idea of self-consciously race-segregated schools. So in Detroit, they begin to create, you know, these schools for black kids with an Afrocentric curriculum designed to sort of instill pride both in learning and in their history as a way to build things up. And those are also, you know, there's a lot of questions still swirling around whether that is that permissible. And that's what happens, right? The integrationist position has remained a part of the political landscape, but a whole bunch of new arguments have cropped up, making a lot of strange bedfellows within the civil rights community and sometimes between the civil rights community and its opponents.
Okay.